Thank you very much. I do look a little bit younger than I am, and I'm trying to. My white hair are coming out now, and I'm not dyeing my hair anymore so that it really comes out, so I don't look so young anymore. But I'm not as young as I look. So basically, I'm going to talk to you about influenza, and influenza is basically everything I've been doing ever since I started grad school. Basically, I've not gotten myself out of influenza. I really thought I was going to stumble in, and it was supposed to be just a small paper, and I was just trying to find a justification for certain parameters I was picking, and before I knew it, I got suckered into influenza and never made it out to this day. And it's basically now it's filled my entire research. There's a lot of scientists who work on modeling of infectious diseases, and they will typically have a few diseases they work on, not me. I've been completely consumed with influenza. And I will try to convince you here that it's absolutely a fantastic disease from a scientific perspective, obviously, and that there's a lot of fun stuff that we still don't need to know about the virus, and it's especially pressing given that we might all die from it if a pandemic hits. So hopefully that will also make it that much more interesting, because when your life's on the line, it makes it just a little bit more exciting. So basically, a few introduction about influenza for those of you who are not entirely familiar with influenza. In humans, influenza mostly only affects your upper respiratory tract, and it actually is responsible for 5 to 15% of the population becoming sick and 3 to 5 million cases of severe illness, resulting in 250,000 to 500,000 deaths year-round around the world. Now, this is per year around the world, and this is in the case of a seasonal flu infection, meaning your regular flu, the one typically that you get really sick, you go home, you recover in 3 days and get to go back to work. This is so this will still kill a few people around the world, but this is not pandemic death toll. There's typically 4 genera of influenza, and you're probably thinking, okay, she doesn't know how to count. That's not starting well since she's a math modeler. Not to worry, I'm not mentioning the fourth one, because the fourth one, the influenza B, is a togotovirus. And it's basically not really treated with influenza. Typically, the key influenza is influenza A, influenza B, and influenza C. Influenza C is the most common, but rarely causes any symptoms. So you won't even talk about it. Maybe you have it right now. Influenza A and B are the most important. These are the common circulating one, and when you receive a vaccine, they try to immunize you against the circulating A and B strains. That's what they try to get to go away. That's what they try to prevent infection from happening. B is the biggest killer annually, typically. So on the seasonal influenza, typically it's B causing outbreaks in nursing homes and schools and resulting in death in these circumstances. Influenza A, however, in a sense, is the biggest killer from the perspective of pandemic. Whenever we've had a pandemic of influenza, it always came out of the flu A. So flu B, biggest killer in terms of seasonal infections, flu A, the guy we're scared of when the pandemic hits. So the bird flu that you've probably heard about, I would think, is of an A genera. Okay, typically you'll see strain identification this way, and you might see me use those during the talk, so I thought it would be worthwhile explaining what these are. So this is for influenza A, isolated in Hong Kong in lab number 1 in 1968. It is of the H3N2 subtype. So the information gives you the genera, if it's A, B, or C, and gives you the subtype if it's an A virus, in this case, H3N2, and we'll tell you what the H and N stands for in a bit. The vaccine strain that you get every year will include one influenza A H1N1, one influenza A H3N2, and one influenza B. So you get 3 strains. Now, within each family, like within the H1N1 family, there's tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of strains. So every year, they try to guess which is going to be the big one next year, kind of like the fashion people, but in a different style. So they get together in a bunker and they try to decide what's going to be the big fashion next year in terms of H1N1. And they try to guess, mostly guess, and I'm really serious when I say that. A lot of it is left to kind of wishful thinking at this point, although the models are getting better and better, and I don't think it'll be very, very long before we can do a little bit more than just guess. But basically they guess, and sometimes they get it pretty damn good, and sometimes not so. The reason why you need to get a new vaccine every year, because you know there's some disease, you get a vaccine, and then that's it. And you're good for quite a while, sometimes for a whole life. Influenza, you have to keep taking it again because the virus itself drifts, which means that you're still protected against that particular strain, but that's not the strain circulating anymore. The strain has drifted slowly, and the one that's circulating now, you're not protected against, and that's why you can become infected again. So when you receive the next vaccine, you're really protecting yourself against a different virus, in a sense. So that's why it's not that the immunity wanes, it's that the virus mutates away. Okay, so here we go. These are the pieces of the virus. I have slightly enlarged the virus for you viewing pleasure, because otherwise it would be hard to point to features. These are all the pieces of the influenza virus, and I've put in orange the important one so you don't get lost in the slide. Basically, this is the virus, and it's got little spikes. And you'll see that everything else is inside. The only thing that's on the outside I've labeled as HA or NA. HA is the hemagglutinin, and NA is the neuraminidase. And that's when I remind you of my notation, H3N2. H3 means hemagglutinin 3, N2 means neuraminidase 2. There's in humans only two known neuraminidases, N1 or N2, and in HA we've had anywhere between H1 and H15, but as I tell you, what's circulating right now, H3N2, H1N1, and flu B. Okay, those subtypes, by the way, don't exist in flu B. These are flu A specific. So what we'll be interested in throughout the discussion, I'll be talking back about the NA, the HA, so hemagglutinin neuraminidase, so start putting that in your stockpile of memory, and the matrix protein. And I won't talk too much about this, other than to say that the matrix protein, as you see, straddles the virus and has a role to play in allowing the virus to actually infect the cells once it gets in. And that's one of the things that one of the drugs for flu targets, which is the matrix protein, preventing the uncoding of the virus and its translation and infecting a cell. So these are the three pieces you have to remember. So I'll give a little recap. Hemagglutinin, neuraminidase, and matrix protein. Okay. This is my scary slide, and I always put it up. This is all that we knew about influenza in 2006. Okay, that's not so long ago. And we mostly don't know very much more. It's not changed, really. We know that the viral titer, so viral titer, by the way, is virus concentration. So your viral titer curves usually go up and back down, and viral titer peak is when you're most virus in your system. So the viral titer peaks usually around day 2 or 3, and here, now that's the fun part. The fraction of dead cells among the target cells in your lungs is 10% on day 1, so here goes 10% of your lung, gone. Day 2, 40% of your lung. It's actually between 30 and 50%. So between 30 and 50% of your upper lungs are gone. And yet, that's the one you survive. That's not the one that kills you. That's the seasonal flu infection, the one you survive. And then 10% on day 5. So if you're feeling really kind of bad during a flu, well, consider yourself lucky that you can still function with 50% of your lungs gone and be very impressed with the very powerful regeneration ability of your lungs. The virus shedding ends between day 5 plus or minus 2. I love those error bars. it's really hard as a physicist to live in the world of biology. The eclipse phase, so this is the time, so the virus comes in, infects the cell, and there's a bit of time that elapses before the cell actually starts producing virus. We call that the eclipse phase. And the eclipse phase, we know, lasts around 4 to 6 hours. Somewhere in that ballpark. The immune cell peaks somewhere between day 2 and day 7, depending on which immune cells you're talking about, and it's even still not so clear. You'll see, however, that, for example, the CTL, the cytotoxic T lymphocytes, peak on day 7. Now, remember, the virus peaks on day 2, so they're really late coming to the party. So they're not so helpful. Day 2 macrophages, they're going to be the one leading the attack. See, day 2 corresponds exactly to the viral titer peak. And basically, there's going to be an increase in your B cells and T helper cells of about 100-fold, your antibody-producing cells, those are the plasma B cells, about 10,000-fold, and, you know, that's kind of a rough estimate for your avian for your annual infection. Here are some things we would like to know, and they seem like simple enough question to ask, I thought, but we have no idea. For example, rate of virus production. So how many viruses does a cell produce per unit time? We have no idea. Okay, well, what fraction of those are infectious? Like, what fraction of those viruses? Because not all viruses, a lot of them are defective. How many of them are actually able to infect other cells? Oh, we don't know that either. Okay, well, by what mechanism does the virus leave? Because you see the times on the immune cells coming in, it's very late. Are they really playing a big role? Or does the infection mostly stop because it runs out of cells to infect? That's not known either. There's another one I haven't put there, and a lot more. We could talk the rest of the talk on this, but basically, for example, what kills you when you die of flu? It kind of depends, and it's not really clear. So you see, we've got a lot of stuff to do. So back when I first arrived in Alan's lab, he already had a flu project together, and since I was already starting to work on flu, he said, how about you just read our paper? We've got this all figured out. Well, it turned out there was a lot of work left, so we had fun with that. The idea of it was, for the first time, he had gotten his hands on viral titers, so amount of virus over time, for a few patients. That allows us to propose a model or a hypothesis for how flu works in the shape of a mathematical model and see if we can replicate the data. So basically, we're trying to extract some of the key parameters of the kinetics of flu. So if we have a model, the model will probably include stuff like at what rate do cells become infected, how much virus do they produce, et cetera, et cetera. We don't know what those parameters are, but if we try to fit the model to the data, we could extract them. One thing that comes naturally out of the model is the basic reproductive number. And for those of you who are not familiar with that number, it's often used in epidemiology and in infectious disease, and it's how many secondary cases you expect to get from a single infected case over one infected lifespan. So if we're talking about a cell, over the time that it's infected, how many other cells will it infect? And it's usually believed that if that number can be kept below one, so below the replacement rate, the infection will just dwindle away. If it's above one, the infection will be able to grow. So the idea is control measures try to lower that number below one. So our approach was to develop a simple math model, try to explain the experimental data, and determine the value of the parameters by trying to fit the model to the data. The little problems we had, it turns out that the different humans have different responses. That was unfortunate. And there was other many factors that we couldn't include in the model because you'll see we have very little data, but that should be taken into account, stuff like an immune response. Yes. So our model, as I say, does not have an immune response. That seems kind of weak, but as I told you, the immune cells kick in on day two when the virus has already peaked. So really, our model should still be a pretty decent model for early infection dynamics anyways. So here we have the model. This is our simple model. We have a slightly fancier one. So you'll see that this one, the first one is the target cell. How many cells are available to be infected? These are the infected cells. How many cells are infected? And this is the virus. How much virus do we have? So you'll see that I can remove them from here and put them over here. It's got the minus there and a plus there. Meaning the density of virus times the density of cells available to be infected times some rate gives you how many will become infected in a certain time step. And whatever ones you've infected, you move over here. And so on and so forth. And these cells, once infected, die off at a certain rate. The virus, well, those cells that are infected are producing virus at a certain rate, and that virus is cleared at a certain rate. The difference in this model is what we have is in what's called an eclipse phase, when the cells have become infected, so they're no longer a target, because they've already been infected, but they're not producing virus yet. They will drift into the infected class at a rate k. Okay, and so that's our model, and then we get our expression for the basic reproductive number. So again, I remind you, if that number is below 1, infection is not sustained. If it's above 1, infection will carry on. So I told you there's no immune system, but if you think about it, it could kind of implicitly be taken into account by the two terms, the death rate and the clearance rate. So the rate at which we clear the virus, if there's cells around clearing the virus, that clearance time will end up being greater than just natural clearance. And the death rate of infected cells, if there's T cells around killing the infected cells, that death rate will appear to be greater than it really is. So in a sense, we can sort of take the immune system into consideration through these two parameters, C and delta. So of course, there's no immune cells in there, and I've already told you that. And we're not including the effect of things like cytokines, which are signals released by cells when they're in a big panic, to tell other things, oh, something's gone terribly wrong. And that can, for example, prevent cells from becoming infected as easily. But we can't put that in there because, as I show you now, we don't have very much data points. So you'll remember that there were four parameters in my model. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 usable data points, four parameters, right? I am really pushing the boundary of what's acceptable here. And don't forget that my other model had 5, right? It's kind of dodgy, but if it's all you've got to get answers somehow, right? And I'll actually show you that some of the estimates we got were pretty good. So you see the black dots are nasal swab samples from patients infected with influenza, and the black dashed and dotted line, full and dashed line, are the simple and eclipse model I just presented for you. So you can see that we have a pretty decent fit. It's nothing to write home about, but this is biological data, so one does their best. And what it allowed us to extract is parameters for each patient. Now, of course, we're clearly not going to go through this, but I want to point out the orange one for you. So, for example, the half-life of the virus is about 5.6 hours, something we found out. The eclipse phase appeared to be approximately 6 hours, which is in the ballpark of what we knew. It's somewhere between 4 and 6, so it was comforting to get a number very similar to what we thought it should be. So that was already a very good feeling for us. The important numbers, again, the lifespan of an infected cell. Once infected, a cell will live about 11 hours. That has been confirmed in further models I've done in the future. That number has come up again, so it seems like 11 hours for the lifespan of a cell once infected is a reasonable number. The basic reproductive number, it's above one infection catches. If it was below one, we'd be worried about our math. Okay. So basically, this model was the first ever compared against human data. There was two mathematical models that came before this. This was the first time we could ever actually apply it to data. So that was a really good feeling. Basically, we found those various numbers that I already pointed out to us, but this model was kind of so cool and exciting that even Roche Pharmaceuticals, the makers of Tamiflu, are now using our model to do their to test their drug out. So that was happy thought for us. Of course, as mathematician, parameters are weakened, of course, by the fact that we have almost as many parameters as we have data points, so we're still very skeptical about our own data. The experimental data was too limited to be able to include more biologically meaningful things. And the other thing that happened is that we had weird units for the virus, and that's something we can't get rid of, and that will always happen to us. It's in TCID 50 per milliliter of nasal wash. If I had a bit more time, I would tell you what that is, but let's just say it's a very relative measure. It stands for tissue culture infectious dose, so it's how much virus you need to infect 50% of the samples of cells that you have in your lab. per milliliter of nasal wash, which is, you know, the most brilliant type of unit you can imagine. So it ends up contaminating two of our parameters, so we now know what the production rate of virus in units of TCID 50 per milliliter of nasal wash is, but we're not going to write home about this because that is a completely useless unit. And it's hopeless, of course, to be converted into anything useful. The next thing we ended up doing was, like, we were feeling pretty good about this. We thought we were onto something, and as modelers do, they go seek out new data. And interestingly enough, data came to us in the form of a drug company called Atomos, and I've always been very reluctant to work with drug companies, but I had a very good experience with these guys, very, very nice. And the CEO of that company is a physicist, so we got along just good. So these guys are the guys from the drug company, Gregory Wendt, Jack Nguyen, and James McSherry. This is me. Rui and Alan are two people working at Los Alamos National Lab, working with me on that when I was doing my postdoc there. So basically, that was work I did when I was doing my postdoc, and what we tried to understand is how drugs, influenza drugs, come and have an effect on the infection. Because so far we have an infection all nice and pure. What happens if you put a drug in there? Well, here's your course on influenza drug, and I think you'll appreciate this course because you'll be more informed than all your friends, and it's a great icebreaker for parties. So basically, there's two drugs existing right now for influenza. There's the adamantanes and the neuraminidase inhibitors. The adamantanes, among which the most popular, I believe, was amantadine. So amantadine blocks the M2 protein. So I'll give you a little reminder. See, I brought the graph because I figured maybe you'd forgot by now. See, I'm teaching first-year students, so I'm all prepared for these things now. So you've got the virus here. It's got its HNNA spike, and it's got a little M2 protein. Virus gets stuck to the cell, gets absorbed by the cell, and what amantadine does is exactly that. It put a little X on the H+. What it does is actually blocks the opening of a proton channel that allows the genetic content of the virus to be poured into the nucleus, which causes the cell to start making copies of it. Because your cell nucleus, your average cell nucleus, is not that smart. If you give it a recipe, it starts making it. So you have to really watch out where you give it. And so if the virus can manage to get its recipe in, that's it. Cell starts making it. Okay? So what the drug tries to do is prevent that from happening. And that's what amantadine does. It blocks infection of the cell, typically. Except that there's a little bit of a problem we have right now with amantadine. In the 2005-2006 flu season in the U.S., they decided to start looking at all of the strains that they were capturing on people. So when people would report in with flu at the doctor, they would sample and decode the virus and see what each bit looked like, what each amino acid looked like, and they discovered that all of them were resistant to amantadine. 98% of the strain they assayed were resistant to amantadine. What does that mean? It means if you bring in a patient that has got this disease, this particular strain, and you treat them with a drug, you might as well have done absolutely nothing. So the CDC was not very happy with that, and they immediately said, okay, we're not prescribing amantadine at all anymore. So that was the end of amantadine. So all the people, the makers of amantadine, among which the drug company we were working with, were not so happy about the situation because their drug was now useless. Sensitivity has not gone back up, so it's still very high sensitivity, and worldwide is around 90-91%. Okay, So that drug, it's out. Other drug we have are of the type neuraminidase inhibitors. The one you've probably heard about is Tamiflu. You guys probably heard that word being thrown around, and that's the drug they're planning for stockpiling in the case of a pandemic. Okay? They're reconsidering that right now. You'll see in a second why. No. So how that drug works is it actually lets the virus infect the cell, so it goes ahead and infects the cell, and then the cell starts producing virus. Now, the way the virus can get itself into the cell is it comes in and it grabs onto the cell receptors on the surface of the cell and really binds tightly, and then it can make its way in once it's really well attached. Well, there's nothing that prevents it from sticking on the way out too. So as the virus starts to butt off once he's been produced and he's really excited about this and he's going out into the world to infect another cell, he's kind of stopped by the fact that he's stuck to the cell receptors on the way out too. So the sticky part is the HA. There is, however, an unsticky part, the NA, who cleaves that. So as he's on his way out, the HA stays stuck. The NA goes and chops it, and off goes the virus. So the neuraminidase inhibitor, what does it do? It inhibits NA activity. So basically, as the virus tries to break off, the drug says, no, I don't think so. So the virus is produced, but he can't go on to infect other cells, so that also participates in stopping the infection. Right? If the virus is not going anywhere, he's not going in to infect the other cell. So it doesn't prevent infection, it prevents reinfection. Okay? So that's how that second drug works, and they thought they were going to sail clear. They were selling so much of that drug, all the countries were stockpiling because they were the only show in town. Also, their drug is a lot more expensive than amantadine. So then it was kind of working out very well for them. This year, where they started assaying the drugs again, the strains again. So they took people in, and then they checked their flu samples, and they decode them and see if there's resistance. Uh-oh. Resistance shows up for the new drug, the Tamiflu, and it's pretty high. And the predictions are for the 08-09 flu season, because the numbers aren't all in yet, because we're still kind of in it, 90% drug resistance, which is freaky. That means that drug is also kind of off the table. Now, as long as the... just not be too doom and gloom here. If the avian strain that manages to break out in Asia and start to propagate everywhere happens to be sensitive to the drug, we'll be good for a while. But if it's naturally already resistant to the drug, things will not go so well for us. So there are plans in place to prevent that. For example, they found that combining amantadine and neuraminidase inhibitor, even if you've got a strain that's resistant to both drugs, it is not resistant to the combination of the two. So we do have backup plans, so it's not all doom and gloom, but basically we're just off to guessing at this point. And if it was to hit tomorrow, we just try to mix and hope. Is basically, so that's what they do. When people get an avian flu right now, it's usually in not so wealthy a country, but whatever drug they have on hand that the drug company are willing to lend them, they treat with. So usually they will be receiving a course of amantadine, a course of oseltamivir, and they're also trying to maybe alternate or combine. So there's different strategies being applied there in those countries as they are having to battle this. Okay, so that's a bit longer than I wanted to spend on that. So what we're trying to do with this is trying to understand, again, how the drug acts. And what we really want to know is how drug resistance comes about, because that's going to be our ultimate plan here. And if we can understand how the drug acts and how resistance comes about, we would be able to translate maybe the finding. If we can do the test in vitro and in an animal, and maybe some in people, not with a deadly strain, obviously, we can start seeing how one result converts to the other, and maybe a simple in vitro experiment could give us the information we need to build a human model once we understand how these three systems are linked. So that's kind of the big goal way, way down the road. So how are we doing this? Well, we start with a super simple math model again. We try to get data from somewhere. In this case, the drug company provided us with the data. And then we try to predict and capture how the drug acts and how it affects the infection. The pros of our system in this case, so we're using an in vitro system right now, we have a lot of control over the infection. We can make sure there's no immune system. We can make sure there's none of that. It's a very clean system. The cons is that, of course, that's not how a real person works, so that's a little bit unfortunate. That's probably when I tell you that the cells we infect are dug kidney cells. So we test how influenza spreads in people by using dug kidney cells. It's kind of the idea of looking for your glasses under the lamppost. The dug kidney cells are very well behaved, so we do the experiments in them. But they're not your lungs. And so this is starting to change slowly, but very slowly. So this is the reactor that we have, and it's set up in a way that you could actually connect it to a computer and have it maintain a constant drug concentration or vary it as it would if you were taking 24-hour pills, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very fancy system. We basically didn't use the fanciness of it. We just kept a constant drug concentration throughout the experiment so that it's easier to model. So we loaded up the thing with 10 to the 8 Doug kidney cells, MDCKs. And then we dumped in there 100 pre-infected cells, and that's how we started the infection. And then we kept the amantadine, so that's the first drug. So we're only going to look at the first drug now, and see what happens. Our model is the same models we've seen before, so I'm not going to go through it again, except for a few new things that I've put in orange for you. This is the drug effect. So as the drug is added into the system, it might not, like the cell might not become a target anymore because slowly it's losing all of its cell receptors, but it certainly will not become infected though. So that term is the drug effect, and the drug preventing infection of the cell. We've got a term here that's the clearance. Now, we had that term before, too, so why am I pointing it out? Well, before clearance would be, you know, either by you breathing or snotting or whatever it is that you do, and that would clear some of the virus. In our little cylinder, that's not the case. So the way you lose virus is because virus over time becomes unstable and stops being infectious. It's no longer able to infect cells. So that's how we lose it. At that point, we don't care about it anymore. It doesn't participate in the model if it can't infect cells. So that's what that clearance is. A last term we added is a term of the rate at which we lose the virus due to the fact that it enters into cell, because that can become a significant effect now that we have no other way to lose virus. So we've added that in. So for every cell that becomes infected, I might lose a few virus to that infection, right? So that's what that term is. And the others are, of course, the Eclipse model. And the other one that I've added is a hard delay model. So instead of slowly drifting from the Eclipse phase to the infected phase, there's kind of a stopwatch effect that if you spent, you know, 12 hours in the Eclipse phase, bang, you end up in the infected space. So this is the more abrupt model. And we again have an estimation for the basic reproductive number here. So what we could do, however, is assess before we do any fitting, remove one parameter, which is the clearance rate of the virus, which is the rate at which we lose virus because it loses infectivity. Because what you do, you put it in the well, and every 12 hours, you take a sample, count how much virus you have. You come back 12 hours later, take a sample, see how much virus you have. And that should decay over time because slowly they're becoming less and less infectious. So they did that for us, and these are all the little points. And we did a fit through this and found that they decay at this hour, which corresponds to a half-life about 6.6 hours. Now, that's important for experimentalists because it means if you thaw your virus samples and before you infect your cell wells, you go out for lunch and come back. If you've taken a bit too long a lunch, you don't have the number of virus you thought you had. So there is a warning here for experimentalists, which is don't go for lunch after you've taken your sample just out of the freezer. Infect the cells first, because you might not have the number of virus you thought you had. But that also means we have one less parameter to fit, which is always a good news. This is the data much better behaves. See, when you have more control over the parameters and what happens, you can get a much better fit. And now the environment's helping me out with the light here. So this is at no drug concentration. Slightly more, slightly more, slightly more, slightly more, almost lethal dose. So this is the drug you don't usually give more than that. This is the maximum dose of that drug you would give. And what you see, in fact, is that the peak is not actually lowering very much. It's mostly just shifting to the right. That seems like a pretty lousy drug. It's like, oh, it's great. I'm going to be sick 2 days later instead of 1 day later, right? No, because remember, that does not have an immune system. If you delay your peak, you're giving your immune system a chance to ramp up before that happens. Right, so delaying the peak is actually a good thing. It's not just that you get sick 2 days later. So you can see that we do a pretty decent fit with all three models. And from this fit, of course, again, we can extract parameter values. And these are them. See, I told you the lifespan, 12, 13 hours, in line with our first fit. Yes. Number of virus produced. Oh, yeah. So I should go walk you through this. These are the drug-related parameters. And an IC50, so the amount of drug required to block activity by 50% is between 0.3 and 0.4 micromolar, and that is in line with what is known about this drug. So we were happy to have recovered something that was known. So we always leave a few that we know about free anyway to see if we can recover the right values, and it's always comforting when we do. But you see that things go downhill very fast after that. The rest of the model's results are a little strange. For one thing, an infected cell produces only 3 infectious virions over its lifespan. Wow, that's real killer disease, eh? 3 infectious virions. Even though cells would be producing 3 viruses over their lifespan, the R0, the basic reproductive number, suggests that actually that leads to 9 to 28 cells becoming infected. Oh, wait a minute. You're saying I get 3 virus, but I can infect 9 to 28 cells with this? Okay, and then as things get worse, it only takes 1/20th to 1/3 of a virus to infect a cell. Like, okay, no. No, we call the show off, this is not working. We were pulling our hair out and just about to cry after months of fitting, and that was our result, when suddenly we realized, you know, those units of virus are a little weird. And that's when I tell you how they count virus. Let's say you have a whole sample here of nasal wash, or snot. And you spin it down, you've got this nice solution now, and you go ahead and deposit it on a cell culture. And then you put a big gel over your cell culture, so that when the virus gets produced, it can only infect the immediate neighbor. Each plaque then corresponds to what originally was one infectious virus. Multiply by your dilution, you know how many infectious virus you have. Okay? That's how they count virus. But there are little problems with this. For example, I zoomed in for you over here. Is that one infectious virus? These little dots? Like, what are these? Do I count them? Do I not count them? That's also when I tell you that they count those by hand. Hundreds and hundreds of those plaques, counted by hand, not by computer. So the question is, okay, do I count these? Are they virus? So again, there's a big amount of uncertainty here, and it probably depends on which guy is counting the plaques that day. Okay, other problem, you see at the edge, there's been an accumulation of the virus. There's a whole bunch of them we lost. Uh-oh. So the count is not exactly perfect. So we went and said, what would be the consequence of us only, so alpha being less than 1, us counting only a fraction of the virus. So the virus we have as a count is only a fraction that the true amount of virus that we have. Oh, yeah, so alpha is bigger than 1. Sorry. So then the question is, how would that affect our model? Well, let's propagate it through the model and see what it does. It divides beta, so it divides the rate at which cells become infected, multiplies P, the production rate of virus, but it perfectly cancels out in R0. So R0 is not affected by the fact that you counted your virus a little weird. So let's say that the real rate of infection is actually such that it's equal to gamma. So for each cell that becomes infected, I have lost 1 virus, which is really the upper bound. Maybe I lose more than 1 virus per each cell. But let's say that's what it is. Then alpha would have to be this number, which means that we're not counting 73 to 90% of the virus. Now, I mean, yeah, you might miss a bit, but come on, 90%, what are those guys up to, right? So we were like, oh, God, that doesn't fix our problem at all. 90%, there's no way they're missing that. So we phoned them up, kind of embarrassed, and like, you know, we've kind of looked at this, and, you know, the only way this numbers could ever make sense is if you guys were not counting as much as 90% of the virus. And the guy's like, oh, yeah. I said, well, what do you mean, oh, yeah? He says, oh, well, after we take the samples, we freeze them because we're not ready to count them yet. And then at a later time, we thaw it, and then we assay it. And that usually drops your viral titer by 1 log. That's biology speech for it went down by 90%. So we're like, huh, well, that's kind of a coincidence. So the act of freezing and thawing will drop your number by 90%. You will have only 10% of virus you started out with. So that was our number right there. So that was crazy that our data analysis predicted, in fact, that their experiment was losing 90% of virus. And then we felt really proud of ourselves. So basically, once you do the correction, an infected cell would produce from 10 to 33 infected virus. And that's the lower limit, right? Because that's on the assumption that 1 virus lost to infect 1 cell. So it might be actually producing a lot more. If you say 2 virus for each cell, it would be double that, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So at the lower limit, it produces 10 to 33 infected virus. This is a comparison to human lifespan. So the infected cell lifespan has somewhat increased a little bit, so this is not the right numbers. Oh, dear. Okay, let's pretend this didn't happen. Okay, the other problem we've had that you might have noticed is the drug efficacy. We said that the drug efficacy, so you probably didn't know this, but I'll tell you. The drug efficacy, I told you, was between 56 and 75%. That means that at best, if you pour all the drug in the world in there, you will not block infection by more than 56 to 75%. But experimental models have actually shown that you can block viral production by 90 to 99%. Whoa, we're not getting anywhere near that. Could that be the resistance we were hunting for? Could it? Well, okay, so let's say we'll set Emax to 95%, and what we'll do is we'll propose a very, 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 very simple model for drug resistance, because we can't go fancy. We already have too many parameters. So what we're going to say is, okay, For the first little while, the drug IC50, so the amount of drug necessary to block infection by 50%, will be 0.4. And suddenly, at some time tau mu, the resistance goes up suddenly to some other level, will be the representative of the IC50, so the drug necessary to block the mutant production by 50%. Okay? So we left this number to be a parameter that we fitted, and we left the tau mu to be a parameter to be fitted for each run. Okay? So by fitting that data, it gives us at what time does the mutant start dominating the population, and what is his IC50 on average. Now, it's a bit of a rough model, because if you think about it, what happens is originally you have all wild type, and suddenly mutation accumulates, and you suddenly shift towards a population that's mostly mutant. But there's a big gradation in between. It doesn't go from all one to all the other. So by having a step function, we're kind of playing it a bit rough. Okay? But it's a good first approximation. We can get fancier with a curve in between later if we get more data. And what we found is that actually, using an efficacy of 95%, but accounting for this, we get very decent fit at low drug concentration and very decent fit at high drug concentration. Not so much in between, and that's not surprising because, of course, our model does not capture the in-between. It's all one or all the other. So if you're at intermediate drug concentration, you're not generating enough mutants to make the population look like it's all mutant. Okay, so it's no surprise. Over here, we mostly get all wild type, and over here, all mutant. The intermediate drug concentration don't fit well, but that's not surprising with a simple model. We would expect that if we got a fancier model, we would account for it. So basically what we found is that this control experimental system was awesome. We also found that, in fact, you were losing 90% of the virus by freezing and thawing, which was something interesting for us, not so much for them, because they apparently knew that all along. And we also found that you could account for drug efficacy reduction by the fact that drug resistance is kicking into the system. So that was fun stuff, and even the drug company, they didn't stop us in any way from publishing that work. They were very nice guys, and they actually wanted to prove that that was the case, because they wanted to make a point for the next drug they're putting out. So they had no problem with us publishing a paper about how the drug resistance was emerging very rapidly. So, I think I have time. How much time do I have left? Oh, sweet. So I'll actually probably have time to go through my whole talk, which is absolutely sweet. So the other thing we did is we tried to evaluate the fitness and speed of development of Tamiflu-resistant mutants. So this is still in its early phase, so I'm mostly going to be showing you what we've done so far and where this project is going to go when it fully comes full-blown, maybe 2 years from now, when our research funding runs out. So the people working on that work right now with me are actually in the audience. So Laura is right here. Raise your hand. Oh, she's very shy. That's my research assistant. There's Ben Holder, my postdoc, who's over here in red. And Karen Yip, who's not here right now. She was my previous research assistant working last summer, but apparently she didn't like me, so she left. No, I'm kidding. She's actually taking her courses very seriously, and she's not working with me right now. But Laura's awesome. And Philippe Simon and Guy Boivin are a collaborator doing the experiments, which without whom we would have no reason to live. And that's me. So basically, it's in collaboration with guys based at Quebec, and they are doing really fun experiments for us, and we're very excited about this. What are we trying to do? We want to exactly quantify the fitness of a mutant. Because right now, the only way they can say, how does this strain fitness compare to that strain fitness? What they do is you take the two strains, you infect the cell well, and then you go away, and 48 hours later, you come back, and you check how big the diameter of the plaques is. If this guy has bigger plaques than that guy, this guy is more fit. Okay, so the way you assess fitness is, this guy makes bigger plaque. It'd be kind of nice if we could say something like, well, this guy produces 20% more virus, but is 40% less sticky. That would be useful, because then you could shove it in the model and predict how rapidly that mutant is going to emerge. What is its fitness in the presence and absence of drug compared to the wild type? So, for example, if we remove the drug from circulation for 2 years, will sensitivity bounce back up, or will that just not happen because he's just as fit, right? So we can make all sorts of really fun prediction, both from a within-host infection perspective, but also from an epidemiological perspective. What's going to happen to the whole world with that drug usage over time, depending on the fitness of that mutant and his ability to take over the population or not? So when we get that information, we'll be very thrilled, and that's our aim here. And of course, once we get them, we can feed them into fancy epidemiological model that hopefully colleagues of mine will have developed by then, and it'll be really useful tool. So what do we do? Well, we're building the in silico model. So we developed a computer model of an in vitro plaque assay. And our experimentalist colleagues, they're trying to build a reliable and consistent experimental system, which that is the hardest thing to do in the world, is what I've now learned. And so they're trying to give us nice, consistent data for us to work from, to extract information from. And then what we want to do, ultimately, is combine these two tools into a single one so that you have our computer tool, their in vitro tool, and the two in synergy give an output that can readily be put in a model. So if you've got a new strain emerging tomorrow, we assay it, and 48 hours we've got the data we need, we run for it, and we can give you all the information. And within another 24 hours, probably, we can start having results out of the epidemiological model, assuming that all these pieces have been put together previously, obviously not off the top of our head. We're not like the guy in numbers. Okay, so this is kind of the streamline of how this is going to work out. So these are the plaques we're given, and see, I was telling you that. You've got the plaque size in millimeters. So you say, okay, so this guy is more infectious than that guy. But that's about all you could say until now. So we build the plaque in a computer. So you've got a little cell that infects its neighbor cell, which infects its neighbor cells, and that gives you kind of a picture of a complete well in a computer that you will have run. And then you can draw a graph, for example, of how a certain parameter, let's say the production rate of virus, will affect the diameter that you observe at 48 hours. And suddenly, I can go ahead and say, well, for a 25% reduction in your diameter, that will constitute a 36% difference in the production rate of virus. We've actually getting a little bit fancier than that now, but I don't really have time to go into the details, but we're getting better and better at this, and we think we'll be able to extract quite a bit of information. We had to build the plaque in a computer, so we had to make sure we understood what it actually looks like for real. And this is pictures of the cells, and I'm not a biologist, so I'm always bad at reading those, but I've gotten better. See, I've drawn for you this morning when I woke up the outline of the cells to show you that this is an hexagonal packing. So if we build our model as an hexagonal grid, we're going to be pretty close to the real biological packing. And now you've got proof of that. You know I'm not lying. Well, actually, maybe I'm hiding outlines that weren't favorable with my blue color. But I swear I wasn't. I can actually probably point one to you that actually has seven neighbors, and I didn't pick that one for the example. So it's not always six. It could be a little bit more, a little bit less, but six is pretty good. And six is the only thing you can pack uniformly in a computer. So it's going to be six. This is what our grid looks like, essentially. So we have little vectors describing center-to-center distances and so on and so forth, so that space in a computer can be mapped to real space readily. And we have two species on that. We have the epithelial cell, which actually formed the hexagonal grid. So each site in the grid is one cell. And we have a virus species, and that virus species we treat continuously, meaning that we'll have concentration of virus at each site, and we use a discretized version of the diffusion equation to see how the virus spreads on an hexagonal grid. And I'll show you that in a second. For those of you who are agent-based interested, we're using synchronous updating with reflecting boundary condition at the edge of the well so that when the virus bounces off the sides, it's come back in because it's a well. So it makes sense. So we've got our nice little cell, and it can infect its neighbors or next neighbors, depending on how fast the diffusion is in the well, and we can set that. This is my diffusion equation. If you're scared of equation, don't look at the top one. Just look at the bottom. Okay? So this is the equation for the discretized diffusion equation on an hexagonal grid with reflecting boundary condition. I was so happy I finished working it out that I put it up. And over here is what it does if you actually run it. So this is a cell that's infected that starts producing virus that diffuses, and it's managed to infect one new cell. Okay? So that's how it actually plays out if you press play on the simulation. And that's how we grow plaques in computers. And obviously, if you tweak the diffusion coefficient so that it's smaller, the virus doesn't make it as far, so you can play with the viscosity of the medium that you've put on top. Because when they've infected the cell, they put an overlay on top, which can tweak diffusion, and you can pick that diffusion to be whatever in the simulation to emulate the viscosity of the medium. Oh, the other cells? Probability. Oh, yeah, so this is just the diffusion. Once in a while, a cell will... there's lots of things that's behind the curtains here. Yeah, so once in a while, the cell will... So all the cells that are white, so the magenta is just how much virus there is, but all the cells that are white behind the magenta are not infected. And every time step, they look above their head and see how what concentration of virus is and decide based on that their probability of becoming infected, and of course, it's greater the more virus there is. But that doesn't mean that it cannot sometimes skip. right? So that's just probability. So this, my friend, is the cool picture, because on your left, you have the in vitro growth of flax, and on your right, you have the in silico growth of flax. And you can see that I have no problem communicating with my experimentalist friends because we speak the exact same language and are looking at the same thing all day. So you can see that these two assays look very much the same. The way they stain there, so they have a different way of doing this than we do. We just pick colored images. They have a lot more work ahead. So they pour virus on a cell culture. They put a thick layer on top that prevents diffusion from anywhere else than the next neighbors. And then they grow these flax slowly. At a certain time step, they wash everything off, and then they put a little detergent that goes in and chews the surface of each cell, like chews it a little bit so that it's a bit more permeable, and then they put in an antibody dye that binds to a piece of the virus, that's the nuclear protein, so it finds it, binds it, so everything that's pink is a cell that's infected. So white means not infected, but white at the center means dead. Okay? So the way it proceeds, you've got an infection wave moving out, and you have two pieces of information you can use. The inner diameter and the outer diameter. The outer diameter tells you the speed of the infection wave. The inner diameter tells you the speed of the death wave. Okay, so we have two information we can extract and try to match with our in silico system. Okay. This is how we determine plaque diameter. You count how many you had times the area of a cell, and you extract diameter from that simple formula. So that's first year math, probably high school math, so I'm sure you have followed along here. So I'll move along. That's the most math you'll see from now on. So then you can make these types of graphs where you have time here and the diameter of the plaque over time. These are the computer plaques, not the biology plaques, because you can see it's a nice, straight, super smooth line. Definitely a computer-generated data. And you can see, as you vary the diffusion, which is equivalent to varying the viscosity of the overlay, so as you vary it, you get different plaque diameter over time. But what you do see is that it's mostly linear. So what we can extract instead of plaque diameter at a certain time, which is kind of an imprecise measure, is velocity of plaque. Because it's like averaging over several data points, so if there's a bit of noise, you kind of average it out. So what we do is we take the slope of these graphs, which we call the velocity of the plaque. These are the velocity of the outer diameter, and these are the velocities of the inner diameter. And so, we can make graphs like these. As a function of the diffusion coefficient, so the viscosity of the medium, well, 1 over the viscosity of the medium, we can see how the velocity of the plaque varies. And in fact, we can see that it's mostly a straight line. So now we have this super nice magnitude between viscosity of the medium and plaque velocity. So by extracting it from the data, if they tell me, oh, in our data, the velocity of the plaque was blah, I can right away tell them what the viscosity of their medium was. And if they have a percent difference in the velocity, I can tell them what a percent difference in viscosity that corresponds to. So for example, a 4% reduction in diffusion rate of the virus would correspond to 20% reduction in the velocity of the plaques. So that's a nice statement to be able to make, and what we're aiming for is getting all these relationships out, teasing them all out of the model. This is an example of what it might look like. And we're still work in progress, so I want to go through this kind of fast because I don't want you to think that any of this is very serious. But basically we find that from the infected cell velocity, we could extract what we call the infectivity, the production rate of virus times the rate at which virus infects cells. And et cetera, et cetera. And we can find all sorts of nice relationship between all of our parameters and easily say something like a 20% reduction in this would be a 30% reduction in, a 30% increase in that, for example. And that's where we're going with this. And to illustrate it with a figure, we'll have our in vitro outcomes, stuff like the velocity of the infection wave, velocity of the death wave, diameter diameter deviation versus time, the number of plaques. Then we do our fit, and we can extract stuff like the virus production rate, the rate of cell infection, lifespan of infected cell, eclipse phase length, etc. And then we can just shove that in a model and use it. So that's where we're aiming. We're aiming for computer software that you give it in the velocities and the measurements you made, and it spits out for you the percent difference, for example, between two strains. And that's where we're going with this. And an example of usage, we were working with that drug company, and they were trying to think about how resistance comes about. And one of their ideas was the treatment right now is one pill every 24 hours. It's like the sawtooth that you see here. This is the treatment they were proposing. They found some method by which you could keep the drug very high for a long time. And they were positing that the reason why drug resistance was emerging is because it was going low. Most of the time, the drug concentration was actually a lot lower than your target. So the question is, could that be responsible for drug resistance? And if you could maintain it high, could you get rid of drug resistance? Was their kind of idea. We can test that with our model. We can see what fraction of the virus you produced was mutant based on the different treatment we gave you. Very low treatment, very high treatment, and you can see the difference between the sawtooth and their proposed treatment is very marginal. So you can tell them right off the bat, guys, probably not going to be a very significant effect. There might be an effect, but probably not very good. So this is the kind of stuff we'll be able to do with the model. So I want to acknowledge the sponsors for this work, which is the Ontario government, who paid for the research assistance, CIHR, who funded most of the research, and NSERC partly funded some of the research through the research assistance again. I get a lot of those. Do I have more time, or am I pretty much done here? Okay. There's one more project I want to tell you about. Probably we're going to run out of breath soon. And this is a project that my graduate student, Mark Barron, raise your hand, and my other postdoc, Hannah Dobrovolny, raise your hand, are working on right now, and it's to try and understand the effect of cell tropism on the difference in dynamics between human and bird flu. The idea is that we know that if you infect somebody with human flu, you get a certain dynamics, and if you infect them with bird flu, you get a different dynamics. So the question is, why? Right? Is it just the immune response that's different? Is it just one thing they found is that, let me just get this, is that it appears as though human strain virus and avian strain virus don't bind to the same cell. So that's what cell tropism means. Cell tropism is a preference or an affinity for a certain cell type. The human type flu likes the non-ciliated cell. So the gray stuff, so those of you who know microtubules, so you can use a microtubule strain, that's what the cilia of lung cells are made of. So if you've got a microtubule stain, you can stain all the microtubules so you see where the ciliated cells are. So the gray strings there are the ciliated cell. And you can see here, they get infected. That's what gets infected. Over here, the non-ciliated cells become infected. So it would appear that the human type virus appears to, at the very least, prefer non-ciliated cells. The avian, so bird flu type, appears to prefer ciliated cells. And so our question was, given that your lungs are a heterogeneous cell population, what could the effect of having two cell populations for which two different types of virus have different preferences, what kind of consequences could it have on the dynamics? And I'm obviously not going to go through the details now because I absolutely don't have time. But what I can show you is that we've got a two-cell model. So it's the same model we had before, but we have two sets of equations, one for the default cell type and one for what we call the secondary cell type. And then we can play all sorts of games with those. And what we found is there's mainly three types of dynamics. In this level of dynamics, only the first cell type gets involved in the infection. In this dynamics, both cell types get fully involved in the infection. But you have this fantastic region in between where your first cell type is fully involved, but your secondary cell type is very gradually involved. That is because those virus are not having a lot of an easy time infecting those cells, so it's very hard for the virus to infect the cell, so they're consuming them very, very, very slowly. But once infected, these cells produce tons of virus. So that way you can have long-lasting, sustained virus. And that makes complete sense if you think about it. If I'm going through a resource very, very slowly because the infection rate is very slow in this particular cell type, but that cell type produced lots of virus, I can have a nice, long, sustained viral titer. So what we're showing here is that with a two-cell model, you can have the long, sustained viral titer that has been characterizing avian flu. We've made a whole bunch of plots, and I'm not going to show them all to you, to compare how the production rate of the virus at the bottom in the secondary cell type and the ease with which the virus infects the secondary cell type will affect, for example, in this case, I think it was time of viral peak. So you can see that it's kind of blue everywhere. But what you see is you got this nice little corner over here that when the secondary cell population, that other cell population, is very producing a lot of virus, but is very hard to infect compared to the first population, you get this big spike where the viral titer peaks much later. But it doesn't really peak later, it actually is sustained viral titer. So we've got this nice little domain here, the parameter space, that we've identified, and it's big enough, it's actually quite sustained, big enough that you could definitely reasonably expect to find yourself in that region. Okay? So, just to show you more plots, so we've looked at different percentage of one cell type versus the other, and difference in the production rate, greater production rate than the default population, and less infectable than the default population. And you can see this nice stripe, red, over here, which is the characteristic of a very long sustained viral titer. So we see that there's a parameter space where you could get that nice high-level sustained viral titer for a very long time that was not possible for the default model and would fully explain the difference in kinetics between avian and human influenza. So my conclusion on this work, and I'm finally done, I swear this is actually the last slide. So the conclusion of this is that we're not saying that the difference between human and avian strain is cell tropism. We're saying that we know there is a difference of cell tropism, and we're telling you that it would be a sufficient condition to explain difference in dynamics. But it might be something completely different. But we're saying if it was just cell tropism, it would be sufficient to explain the difference in dynamics between human and avian strain. And with that, I will conclude and thank you for your attention and give you references to the papers of the two first work I presented. If you're interested, the software I'm using to grow my plaques is actually publicly available for free, and my research group's webpage, because I'm always looking for more graduate students. And that's it. Thank you very much for your attention.
Questions?
Yep.
All the plaques that you're growing in silica, they're all quite cylindrically symmetric. So why do you bother with the 2D model? Why not just
We actually do. So what I'm showing you is for visual impact. We typically only look at one plaque at a time because that's all we need. But we won't always be doing that. We will, but we might be running